So it is September 16th, 2017, and we're continuing in the triennial parasha, and we're in Leviticus 10 again, verses 8 to 20, and the Haftarah is Ezekiel 44, verses 21 to 27, and Ezekiel 46, verse 3. And I will open in prayer. God, thank you for bringing us here this morning and giving us your word. And we pray for those who might be sick and hurting, that you would touch them and heal them and restore their health. And anyone out there that is suffering through something, disease, cancer, sickness, that you would bring them life. Guide us now in your word and show us more of you, who you are, your character, and help us to be more like you. We ask this in your name, Jesus. Amen. So, here, good morning.
I'm so sorry.
No. Right.
You're here. Nice.
I heard you took a fall.
Yeah, but I also had to go back to the garden too, and I didn't have anybody to help, which was a bit complicated.
That's good to see you.
Okay, so we're going to start reading Leviticus 10.
We haven't started.
This is it.
We're waiting for you.
But we're live. So, maybe. Let's see, Sharon, are you
Leviticus
10? Yes.
Yeah, so we'll go this way, and you can just, if you'd like to read a few verses when it comes your way.
Leviticus 10:8. I get to read the verse I couldn't read last week. Let me just get the English up for a second. Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, "Do not drink wine or strong drink, you and your sons with you, when you enter into the meeting tent, so that you do not die, which is a perpetual statute throughout your generations, as well as to distinguish between the holy and the common, and between the unclean and the clean, and to teach the Israelites all the statutes that the Lord has spoken to them through Moses." Should I keep going? Verse 12.
And Moses spoke to Aaron, and to Eleazar, and to Ithamar, his sons who were left, "Take the grain offering that remains of the offerings made by fire to the Lord, and eat it without leaven beside the altar, for it is most holy." 13.
Go ahead, yeah.
"You shall eat it in a holy place, because it is your due and your son's due of the sacrifices made by fire to the Lord. For so I have been commanded."
"But you and your families may eat the breast and the kidney that are presented as a special gift and a special contribution to the Lord for the priests. You may eat them in a ritually clean place. These offerings have been given to you and your children as the part of the blood to you from the fellowship offerings of the people of Israel."
That's 15.
Yes.
Later, Moses sought diligently for the sin offering male goat, but it had actually been burnt. So he became angry at Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's remaining sons, saying, "Why did you not eat sin offering in the sanctuary? For it is most holy, and he gave it to you to bear the iniquity of the congregation, to make atonement on their behalf before the Lord. See here, its blood was not brought into the holy place within. You should certainly have eaten in the sanctuary, just as I commanded. But Aaron spoke to Moses, 'See here, just today they presented their sin offering, the burnt offering before the Lord, and such things as these have happened to me. If I had eaten a sin offering today, would the Lord have been pleased?' When Moses heard this explanation, he was satisfied."
I want to see you as well.
Sure.
Do we want to see you as well now?
Yeah, yes. So now let's turn to Ezekiel 44, verse 21. Danny, you want to start?
No priest shall drink wine when he enters the inner court. They shall not take a wife, not take as a wife a widow or a divorced woman, but take virgins of descendants of the house of Israel or widows of priests. And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. In controversy they shall stand as judges and judge it according to my judgments. They shall keep my law and my statutes, all my appointed meetings, and they shall hallow my Sabbaths.
A priest must not defile himself by going near a dead person. However, if the dead person is his father or mother, son or daughter, brother or unmarried sister, then he may defile himself. After he's cleansed, he must wait 7 days. On the day he goes into the inner court of the sanctuary to minister in the sanctuary, he's to offer a sin offering for himself, declares the sovereign Lord.
Okay.
And then there's this amazing verse in 46:3, is that right?
That's right.
Can I read it?
Go ahead.
On the Sabbaths and the new moons, the people of the land are to worship in the presence of the Lord at the entrance of that gateway.
Okay. The gateway of
the temple.
The temple, yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
For Ezekiel.
Okay.
And I guess it's the temple that's not yet built.
Right. What it appears to be. Okay, so let's review from last Shabbat. What was the story prior to in Leviticus 10? What happened? Aaron's sons. What they were? Who?
Nadav
and Avihu. How many sons did Aaron have?
Four
altogether. Four. Right, right. Mm-hmm. So Nadav and Avihu, and who are the other two?
Oh, boy.
Eleazar and Itamar.
Yeah, Eleazar and...
Of course, and today's
text. Itamar, right. Okay, so two died last week, and now there's two remaining. And they also apparently did something wrong.
But they didn't get zapped for
they,
it.
They didn't get killed. That's in verse, 16, right? Leviticus 10:16. What did they do? Why did, it doesn't say that God got angry. It says that Moses got angry, I think.
Yes.
I mean, it's in the Hebrew. It's not exactly clear.
In the translation.
Yeah, in the translation it does, but hine saraf.
Hine saraf.
Saraf, yeah.
So it had been burned up. Why didn't you eat the sin offering in the sanctuary? What does that mean? I mean, was he supposed to have eaten it before it got burned? Or
maybe Moses wanted to eat some, and there was none left.
Is that why you got angry with the boys?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's pretty heavy deal.
It's a question.
Yeah, because Sefira Chatat.
We're in Leviticus 10:16, so. And the question is, why is Moses angry?
Well, the Eliezer and Ithamar had offered up an offering.
Right.
It was the time of offering. Which seems to be the very same thing up front that the brothers did.
But it doesn't say,
that. Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't say it was about the time. It says, like, he says it should have been eaten in the most holy place instead of burning it all up. But the question, yeah,
no.
I was confused about that too.
In other words,
the blood was supposed to be poured out on the altar.
We ought to read the whole thing. Why didn't you eat the sin offering in the sanctuary? It's most holy. It was given to you to take away the guilt of the community by making atonement for them before the Lord. Since its blood was not taken into the holy place, you should have eaten the goat in the sanctuary area as I commanded. I don't think I'm any clearer, but it helps.
So you remember back in...
Aaron's saying, I would have made that. I could have easily, or I have made the same mistake.
Aaron what?
See here. If I had eaten women, and such things have happened to me.
You can tell me in verse...
In
verse 19 you're talking about? Just today they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord, and such things as these have happened to me. If I had eaten a sin offering today, would the Lord have been pleased? Yeah. So I don't have any necessarily I have answers here. Probably if somebody were to go in, read a little more in the sections about the sin offerings and the burnt offerings, then maybe we could come up with some things here. But I find it interesting, though, that the two sons are killed, Nadab and Abihu, and then in these 12 verses we just read, the other two, Itamar and Eleazar, are referred to at least twice or three times as the remaining sons. kind of like they're on the firing line, and they're the ones left over. So it seems to be serious, and yet they don't suffer the same type of consequence.
And I remember stuff about eating, that you needed to eat it, burn it, yes, blood, yes, but you had to eat it to bear the iniquity of the congregation.
Yeah, that's the weird thing, isn't
eat
it?
Because
usually when there was the atonement thing, you transfer your sins on the goat and it goes off in the wilderness and it bears iniquities to the wilderness. And then the other one you eat, you're right, it doesn't mention that in the eating process there's some type of atonement.
So
there was no eating with Nadab and Abihu, was there?
No, okay. Because that was burning incense.
Look back at the context, Leviticus 8. It's talking about the ordination of the priest, Aaron and his sons. Right, and they're going to wear all of these things, and then it says there's going to be a sin offering and there's going to be a burnt offering at that time, like Leviticus 8:14, he presented the bull for the sin offering, and that's part of their whole consecration, right? And then in verse 18 there's going to be a burnt offering connected again with their consecration, and then, okay, but if you keep coming down, verse 31, cook the meat at the entrance to the tent of meeting and eat, verse 31 of 8, cook it and eat it there with the bread from the basket of ordination offerings. Burn up the rest of the meat and bread, and do not leave the entrance to the tent of meeting for 7 days until the ordination is done. And the ordination takes 7 days. And what has been done today was commanded by the Lord to make atonement for you. So I wonder, if you keep going then to the chapter 9 of Leviticus 9, I wonder if this is connected, is kind of continuation of Leviticus 8 and Leviticus 9. Come and offer your sin offering in verse 7 of chapter 9. And come and offer the burnt offering in verse 12 of chapter 9. And then...
then you have a shlamim. You have the...
peace offering.
Peace offering, the wellness offering.
Verse 15, Aaron then brought the offering that was for the people. Is that the shlamim there?
Yeah, that's for the people.
And...
and it says specifically they brought the blood to him and he sprinkled it on the altar.
That's right. And then we come to chapter 10 where we are. And we have Nadav and Abihu who come in and they bring unauthorized fire, strange fire. And we talked last week about what that possibly could be. And they did something wrong. And so...
Just thinking back to Nadab and his brother, they brought this unauthorized fire and offered it before the Lord. So they basically were trying to short cut the process. I've only just seen it. I mean, there was nothing to do about, you know, we're bringing incense, we're bringing a ram, we're bringing a this, we're going to have a fire for this, we're going to sacrifice this animal. The whole procedure.
It could have been.
Yeah,
they
we
just.
We,
but the timing was off.
Right.
And then we get much later on this whole thing about the distinction between the holy and the, and the secular, or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like Abdallah. It's they basically rush into the presence of the Lord. And I remember last week having this verse in my head all the time. Who can ascend the hill of the Lord? Who has clean hands and a pure heart? They didn't. Yeah, we're going to do it our way.
But what's interesting...
Whereas the other two,
yeah.
At least starting the process.
Itamar and Eleazar.
Yeah.
You're saying they messed up, but not as majorly? Is that what you're saying?
I think I
okay.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, we're trying to understand.
Right, exactly. So, I'm saying right now, I don't think there's a clear answer, but it is interesting that in this process of these ordination of the sons of Aaron, the first two die with the unauthorized fire. The other two somehow live, so it wasn't as bad. And it also says in the first one, God's the one who strikes them down. In these two, it's Moses, apparently, who's upset. So, you know, it's not necessarily God.
But it's also interesting that the Nadav and Avihu happened on the eighth day. So they've been fully dedicated. They've done the 7 days.
Right.
And so then it's the eighth day. So this is like their first job as the newly appointed priest.
Where does it say the eighth day again?
At the very beginning of the last parasha. Was it 9?
That's where we started.
Whatever the last parasha started with. It says on the eighth day, because that was all connection to Ezekiel, was on the eighth day.
9-1. Okay.
And it was kind of confusing because it sounded more like it was during the dedication ceremony, because he told Aaron, you can't leave and mourn your sons because you're holy.
Right.
So it made you feel like it was still within that 7 days that he shouldn't leave. But apparently, I think we found one of the sacrifices. What do we find that said you have to continue to be holy for another 7 days? Yeah, 9-1 says on the eighth day.
Okay, so, but before we continue with this, let's just bring this all together here. What did Eleazar and Itamar do wrong, according to Moses?
They didn't eat the specific thing at the specific time and the specific place.
Yes. And what is that place?
But, you know, it's interesting. It sounds to me like what these rules mean is that this family has to eat in a certain way and certain food at a certain time.
Yeah.
And you mess around with people's food.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's rebellion. I mean, the manna in the desert, I mean, this detestable food.
Right.
I mean, and you mess around with it.
Well, everybody's
don't
on.
Don't eat this when I don't want to eat it. And eat that when I don't want to eat it. And don't eat this.
Especially kids.
Especially me.
But
I mean, it's a very big, heavy thing.
I think the key is this expression here, actually, which is, you know, they're messing around with food. And there's an issue here about food. And I mean, it ties up in all sorts of ways. I mean, bread of life.
So I want to say, where was the place, to go into the Ezekiel text, where was the place that they were supposed to eat it, according to Leviticus 10?
Ezekiel?
No, Leviticus 10, where were they supposed to eat?
In the tent of meeting.
In Makom Kadosh, in verse 13.
Yeah, but in 17.
And then also later, it says in the sanctuary.
It's also Makom Kadosh in 17, isn't it?
Yeah,
sanctuary.
You're right. And in 18.
No, then it's Bimkom HaKodesh, and that's a specific holy place, in the holy place.
But in 18... It's even more specific.
In English, I've just got the holy place with capitals.
Keep going. The next.
Holy place within?
Yes.
You should have eaten the goat in the sanctuary.
Sanctuary.
So what's the difference between the holy place and the sanctuary?
That's HaKodesh Pnima.
So it's the actual. It's the actual.
In the sanctuary.
Right, but HaKodesh Pnima, like.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to bring it, Pnima, to the Kodesh,
right?
So it's HaKodesh.
Okay. So,
HaKodesh.
Anyways, just keep that in right now in your thought process, I want to compare Leviticus 10 and Ezekiel, the passages here. What are the similarities between the two?
Specifying where people should eat.
Well, let's start with the very first verse, the most obvious verse. Leviticus 10:9 says...
Oh, yeah, don't drink wine when you enter the meeting tent.
Don't drink wine and what?
When you enter the meeting tent.
No, wine
or
and...
Or beer.
So a lot of translations... A lot of translations have strong drink, but shekhar...
Have you got wine
Randy,
and
the expert
beer
here.
In Hebrew?
What would you like to say about shekhar?
Quit drinking that stuff because wine is better for my body. So
no, but as far as translation, shekhar.
So is it like sikabu is the Akkadian?
Yes.
Cognate, yeah. Which is clearly beer. We have pictures of how they make it. You know, the pot and the straws and all the traditional. Many cultures still make beer this way. Make a pot
with
clay over
beer,
to see
beer.
It.
Yeah, certainly
in the Hebrew.
Beer,
yeah.
And one of the reasons
Shekhar.
Is
and
that
what, how would that? I don't have it at all.
You have the word strong drink.
Strong drink.
The translation.
No priest is
drink.
To drink wine when he enters the inner court.
No, not Ezekiel, Leviticus.
Oh, Leviticus.
10.
8.
10.
Go ahead, Rudy.
8.
The translation.
Or other fermented drink. Okay, right.
The translation in European languages that says strong drink is interpreted according to modern culture. People think of whiskeys
right.
and brandies.
Right.
But in the ancient world, in the biblical times, BCE, there was no whiskey or brandy. Distilled drink was invented much later, post-Christian era. And the what it was just a parallel drink, basically beer, although if it was made out of something else other than grapes, then they may have called that shekhar as well. But the common drink other than grape drink fermented is all over the world grain drink, which is beer.
You're saying like if they had fermented dates, they may have called that shekhar.
They may have called that shekhar.
Right. Whereas wine was specifically from grapes.
I've got fermented here.
Grain. If they took barley and fermented it, that was shekhar.
Yeah. I've got fermented here. Good. And I remember in Uganda they used to brew something. I can't remember
exactly.
What it was called. It was absolute killer.
That
you know,
was
drunk for a penny and dead drunk for tons.
Yes.
No, if they brewed it, that was very healthy and tasty. That was a beer. If they distilled it, that's deadly.
Yeah, you're right. They distilled it.
That's
something
else. That's Waraki.
Waraki, that's it.
Waraki.
That was called Waraki when in Uganda.
Yeah.
That's distilled.
Yeah, that can make you go blind.
That's one mark.
That's moonshine.
Gin.
Okay, so Leviticus 10, 9 has don't drink wine and beer.
Here it says intoxicating drink. How's that?
Beer intoxicating.
Yeah, yeah. Fermented. But I'm going with beer here because I think
that's
beer is clear to our understanding of what it actually was.
That's correct.
Don't drink it when?
When you go into the tent of meeting.
Okay. In your going in or coming into the, is it Moed?
Ohel Moed.
Ohel Moed. Tent of meeting. And in Ezekiel, what does it say, first verse of our text? 44:21.
Don't drink wine, right?
It says, don't drink wine
when he enters the inner court, when he enters the inner court.
Okay, in Hebrew, chatzer
ha-pnimit.
So this is the Nima thing that I find interesting, connection-wise.
So the inner...
When you're going in, coming into the inner court. And so, basically of the temple, and here you're talking about the tabernacle, right? Which they all can get merged later on when it's built. Okay. So, and there's another big connection between these two texts, which is Leviticus 10:10.
Differentiating holy and profane?
Because you've got to know the difference between
the holy,
yeah, holy
and the common.
Something you use on a daily basis.
Yeah,
like this chair I use every day, and this chair I only use in the temple or on Shabbat. It's not that this chair is bad, it's just that it's
normal.
Yeah. Regular.
But is it not holy too?
Is this chair not holy?
Apparently not.
Well, not according to the priestly tradition.
Because once something's been set
apart,
holy,
it is to be set apart,
yeah,
then this chair is used every day, but that one is set apart to be used for a brit milah in the.
So the raw ingredients are all the same.
Yeah.
It's just one has been dedicated specially to God, and so from that point on, you have to treat it that way.
I think
and if you treat it like it's just another chair.
It's like things that have been consecrated,
yeah,
and things that have not been consecrated.
Exactly.
It could be the same chair made in the same exact way.
Yeah.
That one's been consecrated for holy purposes.
But
this one's not been consecrated.
I think this is one of the hardest things for Protestants to grasp. I mean, it's easier maybe for Catholics that
there's holy space.
There's holy space, whereas Protestants we have this idea of, you know, the whole earth is God's. I mean, and to the Lord, you know, and so
we can waltz
on
into
one
the
hand, it's very that's a very true statement and idea, but in the world of the Bible and the temple and the tabernacle,
and the Jews even today are very clear about it.
Well, here's the thing you're talking about, the inner court. It's interesting, if I could just throw a wrench in from Deuteronomy 14. When you bring your tithe specifically to the temple, if you live too far from the temple, you can bring it in money.
Wait, don't bring that up yet.
Not yet?
No.
Okay, you're going to go there?
Of course.
Okay.
It's like a punchline.
Oh, sorry.
Spoiling is over.
I'll let you do it, but we haven't got there yet.
Okay.
So what about Ezekiel? What's Ezekiel say?
Well, it also talks about the marriage. Is that what you're saying?
The next verse.
Don't marry a widow.
What's the?
You teach the people the difference between holy and common.
Okay, so the priest's job are to teach. Keep going. The holy and the common.
Holy and the common, and how to tell the difference between the ceremonially unclean and the clean.
It's the exact words as Leviticus 10. All right? Except here it's specifically. It's specified that the priests are going to teach that. They are the ones who are in charge of explaining what's holy, what's common, what's unclean, and what's clean. It's an important part of their job.
We're not even talking sins. Weird.
Yeah.
We tend to think of holy and unholy in terms of morality.
Yeah.
But that's not the point.
Because it later becomes a metaphor for morality, so it's easy for it to just merge.
Except people are so obsessive and whatever, and this just seems to be so.
It seems strange to me, because it seems not to go along with what I would define holiness. You know, it seems like a different approach to what holiness is.
How would you define holiness?
Well, I sure wouldn't define it the way that it would say that. I define holiness as the essence of the character of God. That it's what makes God what He is, and it's manifest and essential. If you replaced it with one word, use pure,
yes,
transparent. You know,
right.
What you say and do. That's one word. Let's start with here. So
that aspect is there as well. But then it's like, how do we see it in our world? And when you set something apart specially, that thing now represents, it's as if we've all declared that that thing represents the purity of God. And then we have to treat it that way. If we don't, what we're saying is, I really have no regard for God and His purity. I can just do anything.
I guess I was working from the assumption or whatever that everything God has made is pure and holy. And we, you know.
Okay, well, let's think of it like appropriate and not appropriate. Like, every human needs to go to the bathroom, right? But there is a place for that. And it would be appropriate to do that on stage. If you do, you're making statements. You're saying, like, this is what I think of the stage, or this is not a respectful thing, right? I mean, there's a place, there's an appropriate place, appropriate time for everything. And
but
so,
going to the bathroom in general is not
a bad
thing. It's not a,
no, it's not
thing.
A bad, and
yeah,
the presidents of all countries go to the bathroom.
Yes,
you know?
that doesn't seem to like fit into the idea of holy and unholy.
Right.
The
well,
problem
that's
with so many, like Gary says, for Protestants particularly, is that this word holy has got linked with morality.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
got
yeah.
linked with.
So it wasn't linked with morality?
It is linked with morality, but it's
the overlap
it's
is
bigger
the purity
than that.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's,
exactly. It's
bigger
than
that.
That.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean.
Seems like there should be another word here than holy to me.
Holy to me.
Is
the only word.
Or we need to change our understanding of what holy means.
Sacred, or maybe consecrated,
right.
Maybe
consecrated.
Yeah,
consecrated.
Maybe
I mean,
it wouldn't be. You know, if it was a word, and I'd be wrong.
It's because our definition of holy has changed.
Yeah.
In English,
it's been narrowed
to only
to
morality.
It wasn't man's definition of holiness.
Right. It's a definition that we are no longer familiar with. It's a definition that is broader. Our English language doesn't encompass all that is meant by holy here in Hebrew.
So this definition of holy is broader than the one that...
Yeah,
right.
So I go along with what Dennis said. I think when this was written, maybe more than 2,000 years ago, when people heard, it's basically whatever the king says, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the king says, it's holy. You know, it's in those days, there's no I have freedom of choice. I can choose to obey or not. It's not like today. Today, God's given that grace. But in those days, whatever the king said or whatever God says, it's that's the holy thing. And at the end of the day, I think whatever all these commandments are, is really God speaking to people, and whether they just, you know, like accept it by faith. We've lost that. Oh, did God really say? Oh, maybe I have, you know, my own desires also.
We can decide if we agree with him or not.
Yeah.
Where does it say, be holy as I am holy?
Yeah.
It's in Leviticus 19.
The holiness code.
Yeah.
The
right.
end of the book, it's all about that. And
right.
actually, Leviticus weaves in ceremonial laws with moral laws, and they're both my holiness.
So the holiness is everything. I mean, if we are to be holy as God is holy, I mean, it means having his rules,
sorry,
it's having his standards, it's having his appropriateness,
sure.
It's having everything that we've said.
Let me just keep going.
Can I say one more thing I think adds light? We mentioned holiness is purity, and so that purity is a common denominator between moral purity and physical purity. But there's the other eternity. And I really think like the life-giving eternity is part of the concept of holiness, because things that are unclean have to do with mortality. And it's not a perfect division, but it's almost perfect, that everything unclean is somehow connected to mortality. And it's interesting.
Give us an example.
Okay. Having children. If you live forever, you don't need children, right? Children are a sign that people don't live forever, and you leave something of yourself into the next generation. And so when you birth a child and you bleed in that process, that's considered unclean. Even though new life is coming into the earth, it's like it's reminiscent of the fact that you are mortal. Everything connected to reproduction causes uncleanliness. If you touch something dead, it causes uncleanliness. If an animal eats another dead meat, that animal may not be eaten. That is unclean. If a house has a certain kind of mold that has the appearance of death, or certain skin diseases that have the appearance of death, you're unclean.
Okay, thanks.
What else? Yeah, so this eternalness and purity, I think, are both aspects of holiness.
Okay.
Go on.
That all is a huge subject. Holiness, it just kind of can blow the lid off of a lot of concepts we might have or preconceived ideas. But for this morning, I want to go forward and ask the question, what is the thing that is in common here that, you know, between Leviticus and Ezekiel's text? What is the issue?
The priests not doing what they're supposed to do.
Which is what?
Which is modeling to the people what is common and what is holy.
Okay, and it's specifically
about eating.
It's about it's about alcohol. That's the common denominator here. It's alcohol.
That's one of
wine and no. But I mean,
just in this verse.
I'm saying if you follow that as the lead verse and then come to the next one, it's like this.
Right.
So the question is alcohol the issue here?
No,
it's where you're drinking it.
I think it's to do with the quality of leadership of these priests.
Okay, so
I mean, it goes on in the disputes, the priests are to serve as judges, decided according to their quality of life.
And to use Sharon's analogy about where do you use the bathroom, do you do it in public or you do it in a private space?
Yeah, well, sex that, or anything else.
Or, yeah, things like that. Is that would be my argument here, because in the text it says don't drink it when you come into the inner sanctuary, the tent of meeting. That is the, what do you call it, descriptor, the point. Let's talk about the Bible. What does the Bible say about wine, beer, alcohol? It's a two-sided.
It's a
two-sided, two-sided coin.
Makes the heart of man
good. It also says that the fill comes down to it.
So for instance, the first time wine appears in the Bible is Noah, right? He plants a vineyard and he gets drunk. And it's a bad thing.
That's not good.
Lot's daughters. Let's get our father drunk with wine so that we can have children. And so there's some of these bad examples. And Proverbs says, you know, don't drink too much wine because it'll mess up your judgment and all of these things. And we all know them.
And that's the point here, too, because it mentions the judgment. You have to judge between clean and unclean. Like, you have to have your sharp mind.
Your faculties.
Yes. Fully sharp.
Right.
And so there can be no hint of anything influencing.
So alcohol affects your faculties.
Could, yeah.
But on the other hand, when is alcohol or wine or whatever in the Bible talked about in another aspect? What's it? You,
blood.
Sorry?
Blood.
Oh, right. It's,
I'm thinking party, celebration.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm just starting at the beginning. Parties.
Oh, it's just weddings.
You can look at Isaiah 24, Isaiah 48.
You can look at the
Jesus
book of Esther.
Jesus in Cana, right? The wedding party turns the water into wine because a wine is appropriate for a wedding. It's appropriate for parties. It's often used in Song of Solomon for love. It's intoxicating, love and, you know, your wife and all of this stuff. So it's kind of like there's two sides of this coin. And so you can see why going into the temple or to the sanctuary, it's inappropriate, right? It's for a specific place and time and not.
Well, there's a potential danger.
Exactly.
And so, like, to avoid anybody actually becoming tipsy, you want to make sure that they don't drink anything.
Yes.
Just make a clean division.
So I want to bring up what Sharon just brought up back in Deuteronomy. go to Deuteronomy 14. Sorry. Go to Deuteronomy 29 first.
Oh.
Deuteronomy 29. And God's talking to Moses, you know, or Moses is saying to the people, you saw everything that the Lord did, bringing you out of Egypt. And, you know, verse 5, I've led you through the desert for 40 years, right? Your sandals haven't worn out.
6, you ate no bread.
You have eaten no bread and drunk no wine or beer. All so that you might know that I am the Lord your God. So, on one hand, this gives you the idea, what were the people eating in the desert?
Manna.
They're eating manna.
And then some quail.
Quail, right? And some water from the rock. What does wine and beer represent here?
Well, they're fermenting process. I mean, that's a death process.
Or you could just say that it's a process that takes time.
Or agriculture. And you have to be settled
you
in
have
the
to
land
be settled
to
in
have
the
a
land.
Grapevine.
You have to have you've got to have a social security blanket.
Like grain means you've been in one place long enough to actually have a crop.
Right.
The full cycle of the year.
So it's this idea that you're not settled. You're not there. Okay. So now I want to go to what Sharon brought up, Deuteronomy 14. Go to Deuteronomy 14. And go ahead, Sharon, with what you wanted to say.
Let's see. It's in verse 26. I mean, you can scan the context. Is that if you, when God sets up a temple in one place, which is Jerusalem, and you live too far away, you can't bring all your cattle and your big bulky fruits and everything there. So instead, you just take your money and go to Jerusalem, and then you can buy what you need. And so then verse 26, then you may spend the money however you wish, for cattle, sheep, wine, beer, or whatever you desire. You and your household may eat there in the presence of the Lord your God and enjoy it. So it says, eat and be glad, be happy before the Lord. So you're actually buying all these things to have a festival meal somewhere in the temple before the Lord, because before the Lord is before the Lord, where he is. So that's why it's interesting to me how there's this inner court that you can't go into if you drink wine or beer,
right.
But there's got to be somewhere around the temple that you can, because here it is.
And something I've never really thought about till this week is, did you know that wine and beer are part of sacrifices?
Well, not the beer, right? Just wine.
Beer too.
Beer?
Go to Numbers 28.
Because you're not supposed to use any chametz in sacrifice.
You cannot burn chametz, or you
right?
cannot beer from you cannot burn a fermented object or drink or whatever,
uh-huh.
But you can pour it out on the altar. Go to Numbers 28. It's just one of these things I never thought about. And let's start in verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses. And now as we're coming into Rosh Hashanah this week, Numbers 28 and 29 lead into the holidays of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. And these two chapters are a part of this time period in the calendar. Command the Israelites with regard to my offering, be sure to offer my food for my offering made by fire as a pleasing aroma to me at its appointed time. Okay, let's start with that first. My food, right? God's eating. And in Hebrew, you know, the word for food is the word we use for bread, lechem. It can mean both our idea of what bread is, but also it can just mean general food. Because bread, like
it's the basic food here.
It's the Lord's Prayer. Give me today my daily bread. That's like my daily allotment of food. Which we mentioned earlier in Leviticus 10 about, you know, he says to the priest, this is your daily allotment of food. So maybe in the Lord's Prayer there's that idea of the priestly allotment in there somewhere. Okay, so the Lord says, well, I have my food. You know, this is how you'll do it for me at the appointed time, Moed. You will say to them, verse 3, Numbers 28, verse 3, this is the offering made by fire by which you must offer to the Lord. two unblemished lambs, 1 year old, each day for a continual burnt offering. So every day that there's a temple, and I guess you would say there was a tabernacle, in the morning they would offer a lamb, and in the evening they'd offer a lamb.
God prefers lamb meat.
That's right. God likes lamb. Verse 4. The first lamb you must offer in the morning, and the second lamb you must offer in the late afternoon. Yeah. With 1/10 of an ephah of finely ground flour as a grain offering, mixed with 1/4 of a hin of pressed olive oil. A hin, from what I found, is about a gallon, which would be close to 4 liters.
I've got about a quarter, about 1 liter.
Yeah, mine says 1/4.
No, but that's for 1/4 of a hin. I'm talking about
right,
one.
Right. Oh, you're
one
talking
hin.
About a hin. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so you've got flour here, and you have olive oil. Verse 6. It is a continual burnt offering that was instituted on Mount Sinai as a pleasing aroma, an offering made by fire to the Lord. Verse 7. And its drink offering, in Hebrew it's nesech, must be 1/4 of a hin for each lamb. Mm. What is this nesech, this drink offering?
Fermented drink, it's beer.
You must pour out shechar as a drink offering to the Lord in the holy place.
And not even wine.
Usually it's wine. But I just found this interesting. Here is, I believe this is the only example of beer being offered to the Lord. Numbers 28:7.
And what happens in 28:8?
And the second lamb
the drink offering there.
It doesn't specify, but I'm assuming it's following the beer, because it's saying for the first lamb, it's shechar, and then it says you're going to do the same thing. Grain offering and the drink offering. That's in verse 8. So this is done every day. Every day, beer is poured out on the altar. And I'll just read from Milgram here. If you don't know Jacob Milgram, he passed away a few years ago, was one of the world's experts in Leviticus and the whole thing involving the tabernacle and temple.
He came up with the idea of the uncleanliness stuff being associated with death.
Right. So
death/mortality.
Let me read what he said. And this kind of, I forgot your name.
James.
Because you had brought up about fermentation being like the death process. So Milgram also has that. Fermentation is equivalent to decay and corruption, and for this reason is prohibited on the altar. The objection may be posed, how is it then that wine, the quintessence of fermentation, quintessence, is offered up on the altar?
Quintessence.
It should be noted that wine libation is not burned on the altar, and thus does not violate the prohibition to turn into smoke any fermented substance.
But beer is.
No.
Poured out near the altar.
The wine and the beer are fermented, but they're not.
They're just poured out.
They're not burned. You'll remember also honey is not to be put on any sacrifice.
Yeah, honey can be fermented.
Because honey is also connected to fermentation.
Well, it has that ability to be fermented.
Right, but that's the idea. That they're all fermented. Things.
Yeah.
So
a fermented thing already, it's not the alcohol, but it can be fermented.
What?
Honey? They make a lot of wine in Ethiopia.
I think it's that potential. And maybe if a little water got in the honey, there might be fermentation.
Anything that has sugar will ferment within days. If it's not,
Especially the last few days.
So
if it's hot,
poured
out
on the sacrifice, like but not burnt.
That's right. That's the difference.
The tal we had.
You like the what?
The tal.
Tal, yes.
David's blessing didn't apply last night. Al tal.
Al tal. Al matal.
So,
David said on Gilboa. After fall night.
We're not on Gilboa.
No, we can conclude with...
So is this sin, I'm just wondering, is this sin that I desire obedience, I forget, but that they have to obey precisely, and if they obey precisely in all areas of their life, including food, then somehow God will inspire them,
that's true for everybody, right? We're all commanded
right.
to obey precisely.
Right.
But I think the priests specifically are set apart to do a representative work for God. And because of that, they have the issue of obeying, regarding,
right.
keeping things holy, and helping people understand what holiness is.
It's like
Take
James.
It seriously.
It's like James, where it says, don't strive to be a teacher, because teachers will be judged most harshly out of everyone. And one of the priestly duties in the Bible was they were teachers. They were the teachers of the law. Not the prophets, not the kings, whoever you else want to put in there. It was the priest. That was their job. And I think if I were to summarize this morning's study, I would use the word discernment, that it's about discernment. Just like you have a blade is used as a scalpel in surgery to save one someone's life, it can also be used as a sword to murder someone with. And it's kind of the same idea here with the fermentation or the alcoholic drinks. Like in the last 100 years in America, there was a prohibition movement to remove all alcohol from the American society. And it failed miserably because it started this whole black market where there was alcohol flowing. It was just under the
radar.
Veneer of the society. And
bootlegging.
Yeah, bootlegging is the term. And so on one hand, there is this impulse in us to be holy, to try to wipe everything out that we think is ungodly. You know, like ISIS, they destroy all cultural statues of wherever they were, of any type of. Right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. And like iconography was a big deal when John Knox came into Scotland and in Holland, and when the Calvinism destroying statues was, you know, we're going to wipe things clean and make them pure. But as you pointed out, in the temple there were carved bulls that held up the basin. There were pomegranates.
There were lions. One of the temples, not all of them.
And if you remember the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments say don't
make these images.
Don't make these images to worship.
Right.
That was the point. Again, I'm talking about discernment here, and that it's this whole idea of using good judgment and making wise choices. So on one hand, the wine and the fermented things, you know, mess up your judgment. They're not to be used by judges or people in leadership
at the moment.
But for parties or whatever, when it's appropriate, then it becomes it has its moments. And so
because it specifically says in the Deuteronomy text, right after it says, you know, you can buy wine and beer and all this stuff and celebrate before the Lord, it says, and don't forget the Levite. He's supposed to be doing this too.
Right.
So he's also drinking the wine, the beer, and eating a holiday meal before the Lord. It's just you're not supposed to do that before you go into the holy place.
Right.
Because that is set apart.
It's not part of your worship.
Yeah.
Coming to God on his terms.
Yeah.
I want to share with you, witness with you. I've begun to see that there's a group of people, for whatever reason, are not willing to come to God on his terms. They want to inject their terms into coming to him. I'll come to him if.
Yeah.
They don't really come to him.
Right.
He doesn't accept that. And I guess all of this structure, Aaron's two sons, they were coming to God, not just purely on his terms. They were
coming
when they wanted to, in a way, or maybe not in the way they wanted to. But
yeah.
acknowledging God is God. God set this apart. And so if I treat it specially set apart, I'm acknowledging that God is different from me, that God is above me. He's way bigger, and he's all-powerful. And like if you don't differentiate, you're just kind of saying, I'm equal to him, like I'm the same. You know, isn't this chair the same as that chair over there? What's the difference? I can do this too. And so it's you're not really recognizing God for being who he is.
But the dilemma is surely now is that people don't want to respond to God because we have put rules on. We're not putting these rules on. We're putting our own man-made ideas.
Well, it's like prohibition, you know?
Yeah.
It's when we take something and exactly what you're saying, that... No. Yeah. That's a whole nother discussion.
Prohibition was inspired by the abuse of alcohol.
Right.
Because people were abusing it. They were spending all their salaries on drink, getting drunk.
Husbands.
And families were going hungry because
they
didn't have food, you know?
That's right.
Something needed to change.
They were trying to correct an evil.
And so it
was
an extreme, it was the opposite extreme of that extreme.
An extreme to rectify wrong.
The other extreme,
My grandmother, who was a grown woman when prohibition came up, she said she couldn't go to town because the little town she lived in, 400 people, had three saloons in it.
Three saloons.
Taverns, bars.
Taverns. And you didn't know if there was going to be a fight or a shooting. And so all the women in the town were afraid to go to town to do shopping they needed to do. You didn't let your children go to town because of what could go on in front of them.
What's the solution to that? Prohibition.
Well, prohibition shut. And that wasn't just the little town that my family was in. It was virtually every town in America was like that. And that was heard from the way she described it to me.
Right.
That prohibition shut that all down. And that's why. And then you could go to town and you could take your children to town and you weren't afraid of the situation.
Now instead of taverns and saloons on every corner, you've got pawn shops.
They're even more evil.
Of course, that's what I'm saying.
It's not that we have righteous law.
But now instead of shutting down pawn shops,
if we repeal prohibition, the pawn shops have never existed either. Because the nation was moving toward a concept of justice within the framework of righteousness, although it may have been distorted by the rights doctrine and all. Ever since then, we've been going in the opposite direction. Now, that was my grandmother's perspective.
Yeah. Well,
and that did kill. There wasn't a town in the South that allowed alcohol back in until the 80s.
Right.
You had a few
dry counties.
But even the bigger cities most did not allow it.
Yeah.
Well, it may have had some good results. That doesn't mean it's the only option to get those good results.
I think it was the time.
Right.
Maybe.
To purge it.
Maybe.
There's a point for purging certain corruption or sin can get so pervasive, the whole thing has to be purged.
Okay.
And
but then the question is, do you have to continue that extreme state of purging? Then from that point... No, I'm saying from that point on, or is there other more balanced options that would allow people to follow Deuteronomy 14?
I was intrigued this week in the supermarket when a very young-looking Russian guy was asked to produce his ID, and he had to produce a passport, he didn't speak Hebrew, because he was buying 6 cans of beer. And he was actually 25. I said, you know, how old is this guy? He was 25. So there was no problem. But that seems to be a sort of a hangover that somewhere someone is saying kids shouldn't be buying beer.
That's right.
Is it the same with cigarettes, by the way?
Yes.
It is, yeah.
18 is the legal.
I want to just add this one last point in. One other thing that I found interesting is as I was reading in this whole libation thing about bringing wine to offer to God on the altar, it made me also think about Melchizedek. When Abraham came to him after he had defeated the kings in the war, Genesis 14, what did Melchizedek give him?
Bread and wine.
And, you know, when I've read it, I'm like, oh, he's giving them something to drink and, you know, food to eat because they must be hungry. But what if, because it says specifically that Melchizedek is, Abraham gave a tithe to Melchizedek.
Because he was priest.
But what if it was actually he was giving him a libation to offer to God and bread to offer to God as well? Because it says God takes the bread and the wine as a part of the sacrifice. Kind of like a thanks offering or a celebration, you know, thank you for giving me victory over my enemies. And anyways, I never thought about that, so I was curious. So anyways, may we go forward this week in listening to the Lord, obeying him, and discerning what he wants us to do in every appropriate situation. Amen.
And remember that it's the Feast of Trumpets.